When we start to think about this issue around slavery, I just want to give you a glimpse of that. At the moment, slavery on our watch as peace negotiators is valued at about between 20 and 30 billion pounds. That's the value of slavery. Some will argue that it's the third largest. Some would argue that it's the second largest industry after weapons and drugs. But whatever it is, what we know is it's on the uptake and it could be the biggest seller. So that's one of the real challenges about slavery. And when you think about the people that are affected on our watch, it's between 20 and 25 million. You notice that Nathan had said 27 million. It's on the increase. Let's not argue about 2 million here, because it's in the 20s. And the predominance is in women and children. That's whom we are talking about here. And when we look at the nature of this issue, it's a global issue. Every country today is either a receiver, a sender, or transit camp for slavery. We are not immune from that. And when we start to think about a snapshot of that, in terms of a human being, they may be in a slave situation in a number of different ways. They may be in human trafficking, which is often sexually related, and I distinguish that differently from rape, because they are two very distinctive forms. Bonded labor, which is a third form. Generational labor, which is when you owe your grandparents' cost to you, as well as your next children, so they are consistently in bonded labor. And land seizures. They come in these different forms, of which human trafficking through sex is the biggest entity. And when we think of it in terms of where the hot places are, we are now starting to see not just the likes of Sub-Sahara and Latin America and the hotbeds of Asia and India. We're starting to see what I class as Western or developed nations. We're starting to see growth in those areas. And the biggest issue about the economics of slavery is that it's reoccurring income. In other words, when the four of you are slaves, I would have paid perhaps between $1,000 and $5,000 US for you. But what I would do is enslave you, and my return will be about 20,000 in a month. So I could earn 80,000 from you, and over a year, and a year on. That's the key economics of slavery. It's reoccurring income. And that's the key that we have to break. And one of the issues about that is that over the coercion and the deception that takes place, because of vulnerable people who are not educated, who are illiterate, is that the deception takes place very subtly. And we find that in most cases, individuals have been deceived into it, have been coerced, deceived, and then controlled. And that control might take place in one of typical three types of forms. Confiscation of their papers, threat to their family, or addiction to themselves. Those are the three forms that will take place. So they are in a cycle where sometimes when we rescue those people, they've got no other choice but to return back, because there are no other avenues for them. And so that reoccurring income is one of the biggest things we challenge ourselves with. So the economics is very strong, and the case is very compelling in that sense. I want to pose to you those questions. Why is it that slavery is thriving today? My sense, as someone who has gone around and seen things, is that the moral fabric that is eroding at the moment in our social society is such that human life has been devalued in such an extent that it's a commodity today. And the price sometimes we pay is when we, as consumers, don't think twice about the purchase we do. We make a statement by what we wear. If I had a physique worthy of displaying, I would take this shirt off and show you where it's from. It's from 5050. It's an organization I've set up with a group of colleagues that employs 120 women in India, in Cambodia, and in Kenya. 50% of the equity belongs to them, and so does 50% of the profits. They want dignity, they want hope, and they want something to leave as a legacy for their children. As Nathan had mentioned, the chocolate you eat could make you sick, if you see what I'm saying, because 40% of it is from bonded labor. So the next time you pick a chocolate, think where it's coming from, because if it's from Côte d'Ivoire, as I know because I've been on the ground, 40% of their cocoa comes from bonded children's labor. So check the back packet, because it might give you indigestion. How are we doing? No go. Okay. We'll carry on. Come back tomorrow. I want to now leave that particular plan. We were planning to land in India, and I'll just talk through that four-minute clip. And what you will see there is that the Daleks, which are the outcasts, constitutes about 250 million of them. They are considered as subhuman or inhuman. So therefore, they could be killed for entering into a room full of people who are not of their make. They could be killed for wearing or even tendering to certain animals. They are lower than animals. These people are often in bonded slavery by generational. They are used for rape and also sex in the temples. And what here is the epitome of what you see, which is when slavery and poverty comes together. And the four-minute clip is just to show you some of the hope that is being done from the work that's been done amongst the Dalit people. I think, Mark, you have a project in India that are working with the Daleks, so perhaps that will give you a glimpse of it. I want to conclude here by just mentioning a little bit about Hagar, which Nathan has already mentioned, because I wanted to use that as a symbol of the type of projects that we do. Each of the projects that we undertake is embodied with the use of... and I was full of hope. The projects that we do, they are numerous. I want to just alert you that in the seminars, I will be talking about four projects. Each of those have an element of rescue and recovery. Each of those have an element of enterprise and reintegration. So we get involved with the Lights of Hagar, RED, Beacons of Hope, and Touch Nature. They are very much involved in the rescue, recovery, and rehabilitation. Our intention has been to work alongside them to look at the whole issue around enterprise or job creation and vocational training and the reintegration. So that's the partnership that we are really committed to. The kind of projects that will come on, if I can get to the next slide, please. Have we gone on? Is in Hagar, to date, you will hear, I won't take Nathan's thunder because also there's a Hagar representative. There's been a significant number of those women that have been. And I'm going to just very quickly, rapidly show you the clip. So let's just go through very quickly. They have a recovery, which again, I'm going to stop from mentioning that because if that's going to be in a seminar, I think you might have an interest. The other is a recovery for women, and the other is a recovery for children and an aftercare. And there's also a rehabilitation. The programs of the four areas that they have talked about, the water filter is less so, but the soya bean making factory, the design, and the catering school are just some of the training that is being done for these women. And if we go to the next slide, the other element to Hagar's project is the reintegration into rural communities or urban communities, which are quite important. Without a job and without a profession, without equity, it's hard to reintegrate back into the social infrastructure in which they've been ostracized. Shame is a very big issue in many of those women's cases because of the sexual exploitation they've had to face. So this is quite an important issue that we don't only look at the enterprise of jobs, but the reintegration into society. And the best way that we can sum up the kind of work that we do in terms of this short flight, which is a bit of a hiccup because we couldn't land in India, is that we focus on four areas of hope. The first area is micro-enterprise, the creation of microcredit and micro-enterprise. In simple terms, think of it in terms of $100 or $200 helping to start a micro-business. In simple terms, think about someone who's received maybe 5 to 15 days of training on how to be effective as an entrepreneur. And I'm talking about how to switch on a calculator here, okay, that they might not have seen before. So that's the kind of basics we are talking about. The second is to help those which might be self-help groups and cooperatives. And these are cooperatives that might have a sense in which they might be in a position to work together, groups of women. In India, we're working with about 1,000 artisans who really receive significantly poor income when they undertake those rug makings from the intermediaries, who really are buying it very cheap and selling it to you very expensively. So what we do is set up self-help cooperatives in order for them to get a fair price, like Nathan is doing on Trade as One. The third is for them who might not have equity in order to go and get a loan. Perhaps a loan that might be because they are a growing business. We calculated from the 6,000 this year that has been done, we've calculated that that supports an infrastructure about 60,000 because of the supply chain relationships that take place. We estimated that in 1 year, just those people could do something like $20 million US dollars of finance. So it's actually quite good economics. The problem is the banks are very hesitant in lending those people because they don't have a history. So one of the things that we often do is partner people like you with a better bank credit, until recently, but with a better bank credit to be the sponsors of these small businesses. So what they are in a position to do is go and borrow a slightly larger sum, perhaps $1,000. And $1,000 on average is supporting about 10 workers. So you can immediately scale it up from a micro business into a small businesses through franchising opportunities, to opportunities that in fact great breakthrough. In Malawi at the moment, we are working on a scheme in which individuals like you and I can take, rather than donate $30, can put $30 as an investment which you can get a return from the farmers. So we see it as a partnership. And it's been approved by, in our case, it's been approved by the what we call the FSA, Financial Services Authorities. So there are economic enterprises that are working and already proven. And I encourage you that if you want to know more about that, we will come and speak to you in the seminars about those issues. So I've just given you some glimpses of those. And the final one that we are now starting to look quite significantly in is in vocational training. Because vocational training, not just in sewing and catering, matters for those people. So in your pews here, some of you will be skilled people. Some of you will have senior jobs. Some of you may have sold your businesses. Some of you may have retired, but you have those skilled commodities that are worthy of enterprise to make a difference to this. And when I look back and I come to a close here without that film. Oh. Well, how about that? I did the best paddling I could. Let's watch it and then I'll close.
Of course, in any film on India, you expect to see poverty. But once you delve beneath the surface of that poverty, you quickly discover something worse, and that's oppression. And when you delve beneath the surface of oppression, that is when you discover something that is as pervasive as it is outrageous in the 21st century in the world's largest democracy. It's a cry from a broken people that the world has yet to heed, and that is India's hidden slavery.
Certainly the mainstream till now avoided the caste issue and the oppression that they brought because they knew that if they disturbed the social status quo, they will be politically, they will suffer. And so they didn't have much courage to do it.
Dalits, as the people belonging to the absolute lowest caste, beyond the pale, they can be killed for touching somebody, they can be killed for skinning a dead cow, and you will find the highest of the land trying to explain it away as a minor misunderstanding.
Incredible India. That's the catchphrase from the Indian government in its new all-out pitch for Western investment and tourism. And it's true, India is incredible. That is, if you can cope with the heat, the dust, the mosquitoes, the roaring, hooting traffic, the teeming crowds, and of course, the poverty. Yet despite the obvious downsides to its life, it's easy to fall in love with India. Its fascinating faces, its stupendous monuments, its temples and culture, its bright, rich colours. Most of all, to love its people, all 1.1 billion of them, who together constitute the world's largest democracy, on course, along with China, to become one of the world's two richest economies. But there is another side to India, which is more hidden from view, which exists at a deeper level than poverty. For there is more slavery in India today than in the entire African continent. And there is more slavery in India today than in any country, in any place, and at any time in history. And it is India's Dalits, once known as the Untouchables, who are subject numerically to the worst excesses of enslavement, oppression, and exploitation anywhere in the world. The Dalits number some 250 million people. Their lives, astonishingly, are regarded as subhuman and ripe for exploitation. Every day their human rights are summarily ignored and their lives abused by bonded labour. People are sold like objects, forced to work for little or no pay, and are at the mercy of their employers. Early and forced marriages are commonplace. Trafficking for the sex trade, child labour, even ritual prostitution in the temples, often affecting girls who scarcely have achieved puberty, are all widely practiced. That is, if you know where to look. For this is hidden slavery. In some senses, India's best-kept secret. There is no doubt that India is a great country with a great and important future as a democracy in the world and in its region. But in this, it needs to change. India's hidden slavery must remain hidden no longer.
Well, and as we land here, and as I think about what we can learn, my sense is that I've not done enough on this matter. But I've also learned quite a lot. I've learned that, firstly, God's economy of scale is unlike mine. I've learned that one small mustard seed I take, one moment of opportunity I take, is, it may be insignificant to me, but it's very significant to God. I've learned that when I look back here, that there is no such thing as a risk-free plan. That failure is never final in God's eyes, even when we do it. But what we are being called to do, and I know for me that's really important, is to be obedient, even if I fail sometimes. I haven't told you about the failing businesses. That's for another day, another time. But I know most of all, what you and I do count. But who we become really matters to God. You see, somebody else can do it better than you and I. Somebody else can come up with another business idea or another organization. But we are the sole custodians of our character. I believe what we are called to do is to invest in the invisible accounts of people that follow after us. We need to be, on this subject, legacy builders. Legacy builders not for just ourselves, but for those who come after us. Dare we finish our lives and look back and see the thriving uptrend of slavery? Or could we have made a dent in it? That would be my call, my legacy that I desire. But I know for now we are called to do what Micah talks of. Act justly, do what is right, not perfectly. Love tenderly, show your compassion, and walk humbly. Who knows, you might come face to face with the risen Christ. Thank you for listening.